chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I am thrilled to have Charles Fred on the show today. Charles is the co-founder and CEO of TrueSpace. Well, Charles, welcome to the Something Extra podcast. I have been looking so forward to this time with you, and I told you offline, but it's true, and I'm just going to say it again. I love what you are doing. I love your story, and we're going to talk a little bit about your story, but I love what you're doing, and I think it's a noble thing that you're doing, so I can't wait to share it with our listeners.
Yeah, I'm honored to be here. I think that, you know, you just told me a few minutes ago that you've been at this for 30 years. And I think we're like 280th or 83rd episode or something. So all the things that you're doing around endurance are going to play right into our conversation today. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah. Well, and I have to give a shout out to our friend, Stacy Sense, because if it had not been for Stacy, you and I may not have met, but Stacy is now in Denver, which is where you live in Colorado. You know, she called St. Louis home for a long time and founded this fabulous co-working space, Rise Collaborative, here that a lot of people know about, and just did wonderful things for St. Louis. So we're sad that we lost her, but I'm really glad that she has found your great company, TrueSpace, to be a part of. And so shout out to Stacy.
Yes. Yeah, and Denver. I'm glad that we could attract her, right? So even though St. Louis is a hub, it's nice to know that we can attract talent in Denver as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, she's going to definitely be an asset to your organization, and she's going to dig right in, because she's going to, you know, I know she loves what you guys are doing too. But yeah, you know, we've got so much to talk about. Literally, Charles, I think I've got about 12 pages of notes here.
Oh, wow.
But, okay. So we're going to try to cram as much in as we can, because I just want our listeners to learn from you. But before we go into that in depth, I'd love for you to take me back to your childhood. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I'm born and raised in the state of Montana. So I grew up outside of the capital city, the thriving capital city of Helena. And that's where my family was there. We're third generations on both sides, my mother and father. So my last name, Fred, is actually, it's pronounced in English Fred, but it's Swedish. And we were miners that came in and started help, you know, building the West of the United States. So that's where I grew up. It was such an enchanted place, because you could just go play. I still remember as a kid, the only time I came back in the house, my dad would whistle and we'd be out someplace and we'd come home. And those days are a little bit gone, but it was a great place. I love the state of Montana. My soul's still there, for sure.
I love that. Well, we did a dude ranch a few years ago as a family, Charles, and our son, our oldest son, came back and started researching on the internet.
Yeah,
fell in love with it. He's like, we have to buy a ranch. We have to buy a ranch in Montana. I think there's 1 million people in total, maybe a little bit more now, but wide open spaces. Yeah. And it's just beautiful country.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people just don't realize the size of the state of Montana. You know, when we look at the contiguous United States. Only Texas and California are bigger than Montana. So it's a big place, big sky country, we call it there. And you feel it when you're there. The horizon goes on forever. So yeah, it's a great place to grow up. Lewis and Clark, I grew up in Lewis and Clark County. They spent of the entire journey that they had from, you know, St. Louis, which is where they started that whole journey to the coast and back. They spent a lot of it in Montana. So there's a lot of history there.
Yeah, there is. So for our listeners, put it on your bucket list. If you've not gone to Montana, go do it. We did the Dude Ranch. Every morning we got up and rode horses. They had 100 head of horses. So we rode horses every day through canyons and through rivers. And it was just delightful. And then in the afternoon, we would fly fish, which was amazing, too.
Yeah, good for you. I'm glad you had a chance to experience it.
It's wonderful. So you've already kind of told me what you did. You fish and hunt and do all of that when you were a child?
Yeah. You know, when you're born there, I mean, it's that's not just a sport. That's how we, you know, especially hunting in the fall. That's how we ate. You know, I was raised, you know, that's the way it works. And so we weren't really sport hunters or fishermen. We did it to eat. We stand out on the ice in the winter and catch fish through the ice. Today, I think about how crazy that is, but that was food at the time. And you know, today it's not really something that I do much today just because I don't have the time and the access to it, mm-hmm. but it really is a lifestyle and it pulls a lot of people together. It's family connective tissue for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, because we're going to get into this. You have founded so many companies. Did you have a fishing company or anything like that when you were a kid? Did you start a little lemonade stand or I don't know?
I did not have that. However, for whatever reason, I decided when I was in high school that I was going to supply people firewood, and I had an old truck that I had. And my first business was literally a firewood company. And oh my gosh, I look back at that and I think I worked so hard for so little in profit, right? So you'd have to cut it and split it and haul it and anyway, the profit wasn't there. But I had this idea that, you know, I'd somehow be able to make it. And so that was my first company was firewood. I also worked at a gas station and stuff. So like my generation, as you probably are aware of, I started when I was 13 years old working for somebody just because that was generation. I'm not saying that's the way it needs to be, but that's my past anyway.
It is so true. I know Greg, my husband, had a little lawn mowing business when he was 11, and he would push his lawnmower as far as he could push his lawnmower, you know, in the neighborhood because he couldn't drive. Obviously, he couldn't drive his lawnmower to people's houses. But I can't even tell you how many. It's always an interesting question for me, Charles, because I think it's somewhere in the DNA. I can't even tell you how many people I've had on the guest that have founded companies and they had a company, whether it was, I know one lady had a candy bar company. And so she would go and buy the candy bars and then sell them for a little bit more at school and t-shirts and glow sticks and whatever you could do. Right. So it's so I always find that really interesting. So, you know, education wise, you received a BS in engineering. And then you went on to do postgraduate work at Norton Clapp School of Law in the state of Washington. Yeah. So that's cool. Were you thinking you would be a lawyer or you know, what were you thinking?
You know, you think about the places of luck in your life, right? So really, you know, my family didn't have the wherewithal to do a lot of that stuff. So I was lucky enough to be at Montana State on an athletic scholarship, but also got connected to the Boeing company. And it steered me to a place where I could not only get my engineering degree, but I had employment following it, you know, in 1983, which takes me back a ways. And then Boeing, of course, helped me get back to law school. I wanted to be a patent attorney, not like an attorney we have today. And, you know, in the middle of all that, of course, I was raising a family. I had my wife and I had kids at home. We've been married for 42 years. So we started early in our lives. And, but I couldn't see myself being a practicing attorney. I was using it truly even back then to try to figure out how to better understand the contracts in business, because it really is a legal, understanding legal language is a huge advantage as a business person. Because otherwise Absolutely. You kind of get outmaneuvered if you don't understand the language. And so I loved, for example, it was a great law school because it was mostly professionals. That was an early stage lawyer, people that were going to become lawyers for life. And, you know, legal writing and contracts were the center of the entire curricula. So it was great. It's not like, I don't pretend to be a lawyer. It would be scary if I did, but at least I'm not going to get outmaneuvered by somebody who knows the language and the contract law.
Sure. Well, it totally makes sense. You were an engineer. So you were probably thinking you might invent some things, and you know, patent law, you needed to know patent law. Well, okay. So we've never talked about this, but do you know, we also have something in common. So Greg and I started our careers at McDonnell Douglas.
Oh my gosh.
In 1985. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I was a co-op in 1984 there when I was still in college. And then they hired us. And then of course I left before Boeing acquired McDonnell Douglas, but we started in the aviation and aeronautical, and you know, it was a wonderful place to start. So we have something else there in common.
It was the golden age of engineering, in my opinion. So yeah, it was great time. So that's, and by the way, think about the experience, and they let us grow up there a little bit, right? You got to grow up.
No doubt. No doubt. Well, you know, we always say too, well, Greg was a software engineer. I was an accounting major. So I was in corporate accounting and internal audit for McDonnell Douglas. But as far as software engineers go, Charles, it was so methodical and so systems oriented, and documentation was a huge thing, right? Everything needed to be documented. I'm so grateful we started that way. It was not at all loosey-goosey.
The discipline. Totally permeates good business today. And yeah, so those skills, you know, critical thinking, problem solving, all the stuff that we got out of that, we were lucky. Yeah. We were so lucky.
I cannot agree with you more. So, I mean, I know you did a few other things. You worked for, I think, US West, which was one of the seven baby bills. Is that what moved you to Denver by chance?
It was. I actually, when I decided to leave the Boeing company, I knew I was going to be an entrepreneur, but I was on contract to help actually transfer aerospace quality to fiber optics for the Bell System regional company at the time. And it was great because it got me moved. I got my family closer to the Rocky Mountains, which I wanted to do because we'd spent 8 years in Seattle. It was just one again, back to luck. I think so much of the points of things I go back to are the lucky parts. That was another one where I got a chance to move and literally lift and put, so to speak, my whole life and my career. Raised our kids here as a result of it. So
yeah, that's great. Well, just being at the right place at the right time. Okay. So you moved then to International Learning Systems, and this is kind of what you're doing today, really educating and that sort of thing. Is that really, and you move there as the president, is this really what sparked your interest in training and how humans work? And
yeah, I think my interest in how humans work is a great way to look at that, but really looking at careers and professions that were in transition. So if I can harken back to the 8 years I spent at the Boeing company, we were transitioning Vietnam War era pilots from analog flight decks to digital flight decks at the time. So it's literally like flying a mechanical instrument to going to actually, you know, using a computer to do the same thing. And that transition was huge. So what came out of that was the simulation world, the simulation business that Boeing sold to Warren Buffett. And I think it was 1987 was really like this eye opener for me. So from basically, you know, International Learning Systems all the way to today, that's where I'm at. It's why I'm working with entrepreneurs today, because I think we're in transition. And all the businesses that I've basically built have had that DNA in them. So it's taking from to, it's a change idea of moving a set of skills or skill sets or roles from one place to another. And that's really been the common theme, I guess, across the multiple years I've been doing this now.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, today you're the co-founder of TrueSpace, yes. But you founded three other companies before that one with successful exits to Moody, Travelocity, and then your last one you sold to Xerox. You know, can you tell us the quick version of how each of these businesses came about? Just a very quick version.
Sure. I think, back to luck, I got a chance in international learning systems, for example, I got a chance to kind of go in behind an entrepreneur that was struggling, and really understand kind of the workflow of a business and how you can actually get it from being stuck to actually breaking it open a little bit. But the company that we sold to Moody's Financial was a company called Omega Performance. We built that actually in San Francisco, and we're watching the entire banking industry moving to Charlotte, North Carolina. And the role that was changing was credit specialists. And they were literally changing from standing in front of a credit committee to doing most of this work online at the time. This was the, you know, the internet was coming on four. We still had dial-ups back in those days, for those of you that are listening. But by transitioning that, Boonies got pretty excited because we had the credential for a credit specialist in the new age, and that's what we sold to Moody's. They still use it. We still have hundreds of employees there. It's been a kind of a really fun thing to watch. The next business that we sold to Travelocity was what was the new form of what we called learning content management. It's actually taking all those things that I did in my previous company and building it into a content management format. We had Walmart was a big client of ours. Sun Microsystems was a big client. And what Travelocity ultimately wanted it for was their call center training. But in addition to that, they were using it across the board for basic training across the world. So again, going from kind of this old analog mm-hmm. way of getting people up to speed to content management. And then the Xerox business was really, it was our biggest and most important business relative to leaving something of value on the earth. And that is that the advent of electronic health records really stymied the healthcare profession for providers, for doctors and nurses, because you would go from a manila folder and these massive filing systems to an electronic health record. And we decided to use all that technology that I had formatted mostly from the learning content management system to build simulators that taught physicians how to use workflows in an electronic format. And we had thousands of physicians, tens of thousands across the country using them. If you were a orthopedic specialist, for example, everything from registration all the way through treatment was a set of workflows, and we'd simulate those on a computer and you'd learn how to use them. And you, if you knew how to use them, the federal government would pay you $40,000. So mm-hmm. that's what Xerox got excited about. I wasn't ready to sell that business. It was just, the timing was just perfect in the end of 2011 to do so. And they were taking they took that technology worldwide. They've now resold that business to a company in France called Atos. But I sold my businesses when I got to a point when I knew they were doing well, but somebody else could take it bigger. They could make mm-hmm. a bigger spot. They already had an infrastructure, bigger distribution, especially outside the U.S. And that's kind of what we've done. So
it's been true in every case. That's cool. I was going to ask you that. How did you know? You know, Charles said it was time, you know, and was it something a little angst in you, or just knowing that, hey, what got us here won't get us there and somebody else can take it bigger? And
yeah, I think, you know, as I got older, I knew my limitations. I'm not actually really good at startup. I'm really good at actually taking a business that now has a set of customers that want what it needs and getting it to a place where you can get full adoption of that. But the big bureaucracy of getting all of those structures in place that I watched in bigger companies, it's not only not my skill, but it's not my interest. I think there are other people mm-hmm. that can do better than me. And my value is to let's go create something new then. And that's where I'm back mm-hmm. at TrueSpace now, co-founding that with my daughter, Jamie. But so I'm kind of back at it, even though I'm probably running out of runway.
No, I don't think so. You've still got a lot of runway, and you've just got so much knowledge. And I love that. And the thing is, it takes every piece of that, right? So yeah. Every business that is in existence today, someone yes. saw a gap, someone saw a way to improve, or, you know, a gap in the market. And that's how those things were formed. And I think that's wisdom, honestly, for you to gotten to a point to know this really is not of interest and I'm going to go start something else and let somebody else take it to the next level. So let me ask you this. In doing the companies that you had, what did you learn about yourself? You've already just told me one thing. It was, you know, you're kind of more interested in when something is a little established. But what did you learn about yourself in terms of leadership? Because you had teams. And how's your leadership evolved over the years, would you say, Charles?
Yeah. And I'm really glad you have this podcast, because I don't think there's a perfect answer to that question. I think it's this like continuous evolution, right, from what a leader is. I think the first thing I had to come to terms with is there's no positional leadership as an entrepreneur. You don't get a title, and you don't get to sit on the title and have everybody pay homage to you. You have to earn it, and you have to be consistent. Mm-hmm. People will follow you or they won't. And if you can't attract top talent because you're a good leader, that's the first thing that crashes your business. It stymies it from the very beginning. So if you have an ego that's so sensitive that you cannot take feedback and try to lead people and build something that they really want to be part of, you're never going to get there. So that was like the first thing I had to go from having a title at these bigger companies to literally being just me. I had to create something with enough vision and enough excitement that to inspire top talent to come and work. And so that's kind of the first thing that you have to look at. But I think the next thing that is, and it plays right into some of your education, but leadership and likemanship are not the same things. And you have to, if you're going to make change, you have to create change. You have to figure out how to get through the status quo, which is such a powerful force. I've always been done this way. Mm-hmm. There's three big competitors. Charles, why would you go build a business doing this? And you have to literally break through that and pull people with you. And when they watch you, they'll follow you. But if you get stuck back in the kind of the things that happened in the 1990s was just this softening of leadership that I want everybody to like me. I want to make sure that I'm a nice person every day and I do all those things. I don't think you're going to create anything that's new. And I think that's the thing I had to come to terms with. You know, this would have been probably 22 years ago because I struggled with that a little bit. I want people to like me. I want to be part of them. I want to have great cultures and all those things that are important. But you got to create something compelling for people to come work with. And mm-hmm. that's the thing that I'm learning. And I continue to learn those lessons. And that's why I like to work on stuff that's hard. I think the harder problems that we've been solving, the one I'm solving now with TrueSpace, you know, there's days I wake up and I go, I can't believe I've been doing this for 42 years and I still have to learn these lessons. I just can't believe that I have to still learn this lesson. And it's because the stuff we're building, and you're included in this group, but never been built before. Mm-hmm. I don't remember, mm-hmm. or you just follow the process and the path is a well-worn. I've literally never been down this path before. And when you're building a new business, you have to come to terms with that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's so many unknowns. And Greg and I have just, it's been the school of hard knocks. In many cases, you know, but that's just
keep learning, though. I think that's the key. I think I will talk mm-hmm. about, you know, back when we the learning side of it, as long as you continuously learn and you literally look at this like, I didn't just screw it up so bad. I think I learned a whole bunch that I won't do next time.
That we won't do again. Right? No, I completely agree with that. Well, let me ask you this. So let's move into TrueSpace, because this is where I want to spend the rest of our time. And then I want to talk a little bit about your book. But you co-founded this business with your daughter, Jamie, in 2018, I think, which she was the company's CMO at the time. And then I think she was just recently promoted in 2020, right, as the president of the company. Yeah. I'm sure it's a joy to have built this with her, with your daughter.
Yeah, I can't tell you. You know, I have all my children are in their late 30s and I have grandkids, you know, a 12-year-old granddaughter. So I'm kind of in that stage of life. But to be able to work with one of your children that is smarter and better and just watching them evolve and all those things, I don't know if there's a better thing to happen in my life, honestly. So, and I don't take that for granted. At the same time, it's not the easiest thing in the world because, you know, there's no consequence to our relationship. In other words, we have to have a different relationship than we'd have with employees. But it's just been, it's been fun. I think it gives me a chance to look at transition of what I'm doing, and she can take this forward. And she is, of course. We also have, you know, a real push. And I think you knew this from early connection to having at least 50% of our members at TrueSpace be women-led businesses. And she leads that charge. She's the credible representative of that vision and idea that we have behind it. So that's been fun.
Yes.
And, you know, we had, even before we founded TrueSpace, we were doing research for 4 years with a research firm that we had built. So know, we've been at this, I think she started when she was a teenager working with me in the company I sold to Xerox. And her most prized possession was a key to the office that we had. She'd dangle it from her backpack at school, and she told everybody, this is the key to the office. And so I knew early on. I love I have an older daughter and a younger son. They're phenomenal people and professionals, but they watched what it did to us as an entrepreneur, didn't want anything to do with it. So
right.
For them, they knew what they wanted to do.
Yeah. All of our kids, we've got three kids of our own, Charles, and all of them have had an office at some juncture.
Right. That's fun. Right.
And all of them have exited out. Kind of the same thing. Wow, we've seen how hard you guys work, but you know, you want your children to, you want them to do things that make them happy and fulfilled. And, you know, we never push that on our kids, but I'll tell you a really funny story and then we need to take a quick break. So and nobody come after me for child labor laws. Okay. But when Jordan and Paige, our two oldest, were like 11 and 12, we had them, we still had checks and we were having them stuff the checks in the envelopes. And they did that for about 2 weeks. There were a few other things that we had them doing as well, but they came to us and said, we want a raise. We see what some of these people are making and we need to be making more money. And we're like, well, what value are you bringing me? How have you upskilled yourself? You know, it was so funny, but we kind of had a little mutiny on our hands there. And they said, you know, we're being underpaid. It was just so funny. But I love those stories and going back and remembering those things. But we do need to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Charles Fred on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
So welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with Charles Fred. We've been having an amazing conversation, and I can't even wait. I'm so excited to get into this next part because I want him to tell the listeners, I want him to tell you more about TrueSpace, what they're doing, what their mission is, and then we'll kind of get into a little bit more the tactical piece of the research that they did with Gallup. So tell us the mission of TrueSpace, Charles.
Yeah, I'll tell you the mission in context of what TrueSpace is. The name comes from this. Imagine for a moment that you were standing next to all the businesses in the country that were past the startup. In other words, they had customers, they had employees, but they weren't scaling yet. That's a distinct space between there called TrueSpace. And we came up with that because startups and scale-ups are not connected. There's a very distinct and usually a long-term gap between there. There's 2.1 million of those companies in the United States today. Many of them are stuck. They work very hard to get their business to grow. They've been doing the same thing for many years. We'll talk a little bit more about that here in a few minutes, but that's really what we're trying to do. So the big idea that we have, the vision, if this was the equivalent to NASA, it's not landing on the moon. The vision of NASA is to learn from the universe. We believe that those companies that are between startup and scale up could be the greatest job creators in the world. And just a small movement in those businesses, potentially toward 10 million in revenues, could create anywhere from 17 to 30 million new jobs. Today, by themselves, they represent 40% of the nation's jobs. If you're driving down the road at a major freeway and you look at the cars next to you and you're commuting to work, four of 10 of them are commuting to work or potentially at home nowadays with a business that's between starting and scaling. So that's why this is such an important part. So we think that our big idea is that our big vision is to create about 500,000 net new jobs in the next few years, or excuse me, let's call it the next decade. But to do that is basically difficult to do because most of us are pretty skeptical for people coming in and helping you grow. One of the most fascinating things that I've seen here recently, there's 1.1 billion 900 million hits on Google if you look at people that can help you grow your business. It could be what papers, consultants, whatever. There's a lot of people out there helping you. I'm a business growth expert. That's their thing, or I'm going to help you sell more or whatever it is. And the long and the short of it is that 44-year record of looking at the Small Business Administration data and also the data that we have with Gallup, that businesses that are stuck remain stuck for an awful long period of time. So the things that we're going to be able to do at TrueSpace, of course, is I will talk about a little bit about that today, is the data that we've presented, because I think it changes how we see the opportunity. Mm-hmm. So that's what we really want to do. But at the end of the day, if I were to look at the thing I want to leave behind, I want to change the way we speak about these businesses, because it's pejorative today. It's negative. The companies that are in TrueSpace are not rapid, hyper-growth, darling businesses of the investors. They're not unicorns. They're not going to be unicorns. They're not in a position to do that. 4 out of 5 of the companies that get to 10 million in the United States are bootstrapped. 80% of them are bootstrapped. So I want to change from this rapid, fast, hyper-growth narrative to what we call predictable growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from our previous conversations, I still want you to hustle. I still want grit. I still want you to work hard. I just want you to do it more predictably. And to do that, we have to see our business with data. And so we've been on a 10-year journey to figure out what data could I show you that would take all of the emotion and judgment out of growth and just say, here's what you're capable of doing. And in essence, that's what we do at TrueSpace. So we offer a new model of business building that is what we call predictable. And what it does is it changes where you spend your time, how you deploy capital, and how you bring on talent. Time, capital, and talent are the three resources that our data will directly influence in your world. And those of us that are entrepreneurs know that those are the things that we worry the most about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're doing. And we did this in a, you know, pretty diligent way. So
I love it. And to your point, what you guys are doing, it's backed by data. Yes. And it's backed by lots of research. I went in and downloaded the 5 condition assessment that you guys put together with Gallup. It is 43 pages or something like that.
Sorry.
And it's wonderful. There is so much good in there. Can you, like, you know, we've got the alignment condition, the discipline condition. Can you just very briefly touch on each of those, Charles, and kind of tell our listeners what I would highly recommend our listeners go download it if you're interested in this kind of thing and seeing about, you know, you already said it's not the hyper growth, it's incremental growth that's really the sustainable for companies. And I love that. But there's just good stuff in there. Can you explain each of the 5 conditions very briefly for us?
I will. And I'll actually start with the systems that create those. So if you're sitting there, if you're listening to us today, which I hope you are, and I hope you hang in there with us a little bit longer, your human body has 11 systems in it that we, as in the medical profession, have determined there's 11 systems, so we can go learn from the system, digestive, endocrine, nervous, and so forth. But most importantly, so that we can diagnose and treat a system. Even though your body is incredibly interconnected, right? Nervous and digestive are tightly connected and all those things, right? So the 10-year study we've had includes 4 years of qualitative study. So we took 150 companies and lived with them for 4 years. I mean, nothing's ever, you know, according to Gallup, it's the deepest and broadest qualitative study of businesses between starting and scaling ever done before. So this isn't survey data. This is me literally living and watching how you're doing things inside your business for 4 years. The reason we got Gallup involved is that we wanted mathematic backing. We wanted to look at the data that we looked at qualitatively and to say, mathematically, if we could see what we're seeing, can we prove it, you know, with math? Well, here's what we were proving, is that we found 12 systems in every business that exists, very similar to the 11 systems in the human body. They're there, whether you're using them, you know, voluntarily or involuntarily, they're in your business. Focus, for example, is a system. Accountability is a system. Lead generation is a system. Endurance is a system. So I could take those systems, and now with Gallup's health, mathematically, I could diagnose and treat those systems, just like your human body. So the reason we came up with conditions is that the cardiovascular part of your body has basically two systems. Cardiovascular or circulation is a condition. You have to have circulation in order to get oxygen throughout the body. So we decided to put conditions in to connect the systems to. Alignment is a condition like circulatory condition in your body. And a circulatory system has heart and lungs. Those are two different systems, right? Well, alignment has three systems, which we call direction, focus, and structure. Structure is actually a system for both capital and leadership. So what Gallup did is took all this data that we have and put it into a format of which we could now go mathematically diagnose the 12 systems. Mm-hmm. And we put it into the conditions that have to exist for those systems to operate. We call that alignment, discipline, predictability, endurance, and value creation. And alignment is the effective use of time, capital, and talent. Discipline is repeat performance or scale. Predictability is the way you're learning from your business and putting that into the assumptions. Endurance is actually knowing that you have to endure the journey with your stakeholders for a much longer period than you ever thought. And value creation is why you're doing all this in the first place. And we can measure whether you're creating value every day or not, or you're just working hard. You're just waiting for Saturday, right? So that's the structure. And it's so unique because there's no judgment in it. It's just like your blood pressure is your blood pressure. Your ability to have an accountability system in your business is there. And I can measure your capability of using that system to grow predictably. I can measure it mathematically. And that's where you start from at TrueSpace. So I don't come in and say, hey, you're sort of good, sort of bad. Let's do this. Let's work on sales. Let's work on your vision. We look at this structure in one picture. It's called the shape of your business. And that's what we get to see. And the last thing that Gallup did for us is then built a benchmark, a comparative benchmark of your company versus high-performing businesses that are roughly at 30 million, that use all 12 systems fairly effectively, that have grown at least 25% for the last 3 years. And you can compare your business to their shape to your shape.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like we call it seeing your business with science. The science of business building is the whole idea. But by doing this, you finally get away from people judging your business, because you also get to see where you're killing it. You get to see where you're right. Really doing well.
And some of those systems, I'm sure you are killing it.
Absolutely are. I've mm-hmm. never seen a company that's passed, that's got a few customers that isn't doing something really well.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that didn't go too long, but that's the idea. So that's how we do this. That's the method we use.
Right. I find it so fascinating. And I just, the adage that just came in my head was know thyself, know yes. thyself, and really getting very clear, getting clarity as the entrepreneur, as the president, whatever the case may be, because you may have taken over from an entrepreneur, but you're still in that second stage of the business. Just getting clarity about your business and where you are killing it, where the gaps are, I think is just, it's beautiful. It is beautiful. What a gift. What a gift you guys are doing for these businesses, Charles. All marching toward that, you know, half a million jobs created, which is going to be awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the data, if I would have had this as an entrepreneur, you said this earlier in our conversation, but it would have saved me so much, because the trial and error process is still necessary. But what if I had a little more intention behind my trials versus just trying things?
Mm-hmm.
The focus data we have on businesses on how they're spending their resources is mind-blowing, because it'll show you if you are not focused in a market where you can stand out, and you're a business that's not into the middle markets yet, you're not past 10 million. Your waste of resources, especially around selling, is dramatic. You just can't see it. It's just, you can't see it. And, you know, we laud companies with our new CRM systems, Salesforce.com and HubSpot. National averages that from qualified lead to close nationally for business to business models, this is granted, there's a lot of other different models, is less than 20%. Let's just say 17 to 20% close ratio from qualified lead to close. So strategies come in. Well, you need more leads, Charles. If we had more leads, we'd be great. Let's go raise some capital and get some more leads. Just all you're doing is you're looking at a process that is a system that has 80% waste. If it was a manufacturing system to produce leads, which it sort of is, you've got a trash heap out back with 80% of scrap in it. So mm-hmm. the average or the benchmark we have from Gallup's work is that the best performing companies, the threshold, the minimum number is 48%. So to do that, you have to be in a place where your offer is in a smaller pond until you get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, mm-hmm. you're diluting, you're losing so many deals, and you need more salespeople, and you need more marketing, and you need all these things. And if you narrow and you narrow that focus, you actually start seeing a higher win rate, and that higher win rate amplifies through the entire firm. So that's what we got. That's what we can see with the data. We can see where you stand there.
And yeah.
It's fun.
Greg always says the data never lies. Data does not lie. It's very black and white, isn't it?
I just hate the data sometimes. Like, who do I call?
Right. Yeah. 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 But, you know, I mean, our intuition, sometimes we are doing things with our gut. I tend to be more of an intuitive leader. Greg, being a software engineer, is a very analytical leader. But I think you need both. And the data, when you do have that data, you know, it's very telling, I think. Well, let's move into real quickly before we get into something extra. I want to talk about your book. I mean, you've got several books. You're a best-selling author. Okay. I bought The 24-Hour Rule. And I love the subtitle on this, Charles, Leading in a Frenetic World.
Yeah.
And my goodness, aren't we sometimes frenetic? And, you know, you dedicated this. I love this. You dedicated this to your wife, Julie. And I know you guys have been married for 2 years. You said she's a talented potter. She's been shaping and molding you for over 40 years. And I love that. So,
yeah, we met. She's my high school sweetheart. We, you know, that's our history. My kids would tell you that's because there are only two people in Montana. So we have to be default, right? So
it's funny.
Been really lucky there. Yeah. She's, mm-hmm. she's still trying to figure out how to put me into a shape that makes sense.
Shaping and molding you for over 40 years. Well, Greg and I will celebrate our 40th this coming December, and we were also high school sweethearts. Exactly. So we've shaped one another truly over the years. Definitely. But so I know that you've shaped her as well. So you talk about in your book, you talk about the stress contagion effect.
Yes. Yeah.
And tell our listeners about that.
When you're a researcher with, I think, as much when we threw the net out to study companies, the one thing we were studying was turnover, because turnover, people that were unplanned. In other words, your best employees came into you one day and said, you know, Charles, I just can't work here anymore. That person is just rich with information of what's happening inside the company. So we naively decided we were going to do the exit interviews for all the companies we were researching. We ended up doing almost 2,000 of these interviews. And we had the capability of putting those into a natural language processor and looking at themes. So we could look at the themes because we recorded the interviews using the same set of questions. And it kind of defied a little bit of the Gallup data for bigger companies where you leave because of your manager. It's the manager, you know, kind of idea. And I have no doubt in a big company, that's it. But in the companies that we work with that are less than 10 million, striving to get there, working crazy every day, working, you know, probably 6.5 or more days a week, people were leaving because they were stressed out. And this isn't generational. This is across every generation. So you can't blame it on a millennial generation or something. It's, mm-hmm. it's my generation plus. And the tone was set at the top of these companies to be nuts. And I think what we're trying to do is follow a little bit of the billionaire world that it's all persona based. It's not true. They, you know, these billionaires read 100 books a year. They run an Ironman. They don't sleep. They do all these things. And we try to follow those things. And what happens is there's a wake effect from us as founders and leaders. And we cannot see it. We're the lead person, we're the lead dog running, and we can't see what's happening. So we're up at 2 a.m. So I send you a text or an email. And believe it or not, you respond to it. And the next day in the office, I go, oh man, congratulations. You responded to my email. I'm so proud of you. And that sets this tone and this pace of frenzy and frenetic. Mm-hmm. And over time, what happens to a lot of people that are top performers is that they've sacrificed everything to try to meet that expectation. Family, friends, their health, everything has been sacrificed. And the only way out is to leave. Their only way out. And the entrepreneur, when we went back and interviewed those people, they were like, I had no idea. I had no mm-hmm. idea they were that stressed out. But you're setting the pace. So the contagion effect is because of technology spread. We actually wrote about Mary Mallon, who was Typhoid Mary at the time. You know, this was pre-COVID when we did the research.
Right.
But it's like that, because you can spread that stress so mm-hmm. quickly in the organization. And it's not toxic. It's actually, it's got its own pattern signature. We saw it in the data. It's just people finally just say, there's only one way to get away from this, and that is I have to go do something else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So stressed out, people don't think straight. And that's it. That's the other thing we saw.
And people get sick. I mean, stress causes physical illness. We have data that proves that too. So, you know, you say that there's really a need for a new model. And you talk about Peter Serge, I think, an MIT professor that made popular understanding of mental models. The mindset of moving faster, possibly getting more things done, sleeping less, it's not working. So now I want to move into the discipline of the pause. And you even have a story about that where, you know, thank goodness you paused, right? You made an assumption on something, but tell us about the discipline of the pause. It's not a delay. It's a discipline.
It is. It's not asking anybody to delay. It's probably one of the most important disciplines. So I think the genesis of this is that, you know, it's great speaking with you today just because of your longevity of family and things. But when my first daughter was born in 1985, I was pretty young. I was 27 years old, or excuse me, 22 years old when my first was born. So I started keeping a daily journal of, because I had no idea what I was doing and I didn't want to screw it up. And you're in that early stage. And I would write about, you know, at that time, parenthood and lessons and trying to be a good father and all those things. And of course, we ultimately had three kids within the next 6 years. So we were pretty busy. And I got to a place where I didn't want to break this habit because I'd been doing it daily. And you know, those things, those habits, like, oh, I don't want to, I think I need to write something in my journal today because I want to keep the trend going. So with the exception of about 200 days when I was undergoing cancer treatment, I've basically have 14,000 pages of notes that have gone that period of time. So I tell you that because I can go back and look at those pages. And if I were walking them, it'd be, you know, about 12 miles of walking across those pages. There's one thing I could see every time I tried to control something that I had no control over. And I tried, oh my gosh, I tried everything from some relationships to the economy, profitability, my bit, all the things that I had some, in some cases, very little control over. The one thing I had total control over was the thing I kept leaving to chance. And that was how I responded and reacted to other people. I have total control over that. Nobody else has control over that but me. So when I look back and said, what are the challenges that I created for my people that were working with me and for me or my family or whatever, it's because I wasn't pausing. I would just literally respond and react. And so pause is not a delay. It literally is a discipline, leadership discipline, by which even if it's just 5 seconds, give yourself a chance to reset before you send off an email, a text or whatever. 24 hours is the best. That's why we use the word 24-hour rule, because I can't tell you how many times I've been all stressed and I've at least put in a, you know, a decent night's sleep and I woke up and it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. And I responded in a totally different way.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, we can't control the weather, the world economy. There's so many things we can't control, but we can control that for sure.
Yes.
So take charge of it. That's the whole idea.
Take charge of it. Yeah. And I think the two operative words there are react and respond. They're two different words, right? Because the reacting is immediately reacting to whatever that stressor is or that conversation, whatever the case may be. But responding, giving yourself that 24-hour, preferably pause, Charles, allows you to respond and respond in a much better way. But I just think it's so good. Such a great little book that you've written here. Well, let me ask you this. This is called Something Extra. What do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
I want to return to the pause. So let me expand on it a little bit. Cause I think, thank you for bringing up the book. And that was a big part of our research, is that we'd find these little discoveries. And that was one of them. But for me, when I talk about the discipline of leadership, as you really look at the things that you do as a leader, it is the trial and error process, and you have to continuously learn. And so what pause does for me in this something extra is it allows me to reflect on the person that I'm going to about to respond to. And my something extra is, in all those years of journaling, I can tell you this factually, that when I thought something was awful, given enough time to think about it, it really wasn't that bad. things are not as bad as we make up in our mind. And we're usually responding and reacting as if this is the worst thing that could ever happen, or this person's done something egregious to me or whatever. And the last part of it is it pulls the thought away from you and returns it to them. It gets us out of self-centeredness that we have in this nanosecond world of technology today. And we wouldn't have people having to apologize with, you know, Twitter and X anymore. We wouldn't have people always saying, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I shouldn't have said that. All it takes is just a little pause, and we can do it. It's a discipline. You have to build it. You have to practice it. But the rewards are great for a leadership perspective.
It's powerful. Charles, this has been so much fun.
Thank you so much.
This was so good. I cannot wait for our listeners to learn from you. And, you know, it just makes me want to do a podcast number two with you, second episode.
Well, one thing we should probably talk about in the future at some point in time, whether it's a podcast or not, the new set of data we have is where entrepreneurs, high-performing entrepreneurs spend their time versus low-performing entrepreneurs.
Oh,
because
that's
good. Because we can save it right from your calendar. And I can show you with data, without judgment, just data, low-performing here, high-performing there. So that would be
love
a fun.
Let's do it. All right. Well, Charles, thanks so much again for your time. Have a great rest of your day.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.